Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
It was one of those afternoons in November when whatever little light there was begins to evaporate shortly after midday. It was 1964, and I had just turned 12. And it was a Saturday. I know this because my mother had called me in from the football field across the road from our house and told me it was time for confession. "Can I not go tonight?" I'd asked, only to be told in no uncertain terms that night confession was for adults and I'd have no business being there. And furthermore, I could cool my heels while I was waiting to be heard and think about what I had done. This last remark was a reminder to make sure that I mentioned the fact that I'd taken 5 Woodbine cigarettes from my uncle's shop and got caught by my mother after I'd smoked them and vomited. It wasn't enough that I'd been marched back to the shop, made to admit my larceny, and to fork out my pocket money as restitution. Making amends to my uncle was not enough. Now I had to make amends to God. On the road outside, my friend, with whom I'd been playing football, was waiting. "Are you ready to finish the match?" he asked. "I have to go to confession," I said. "Oh, right. So I'll walk down with you." And off we set. Down Matt Neal's Hill, through Carlow Gate, across the school lane, and into the church grounds. Darkness was already knocking at the main door, and inside the aisle was lit only by the dull red glow of the sanctuary lamp. We scuttled nervously past the graves of the priests buried beneath the floor and turned into the side aisle. Here, a solitary 40-watt bulb burned wearily, lighting the few pews closest to the confession box. Hearing the low voice of the curate from the box, we slid into the seat closest to the confessional and waited. And then we heard a second voice, that of a woman. Hers was louder and clearer, and in seconds we were eavesdropping on her life, her worries, her doubts, her past, and her struggles with the present. We were hearing about issues that were never discussed in either of our homes. Details about love and lust and sexuality. Not totally understanding, nevertheless, we were fascinated by the woman's words and her tears and by the priest's gentle responses. And then the door of the side aisle opened and a man slipped into the seat in front of us, taking his rosary beads from his pocket as he knelt. Within seconds, he too became aware of the story being told in the confessional. Immediately, he stood up and, turning to my friend and myself, he said, "We'll wait outside, lads, come on." His tone was kindly but definite, and we knew better than to argue. In the near darkness of the churchyard, the three of us sat on the concrete step at the foot of the bell. "Did you lads ever hear about the night this bell rang on its own?" "No," we echoed. "Would you like to?" "Yeah." It's a frightening story. Happened in November, the month of the dead. This month we're in now. Not sure I should tell it." "Go on, tell it, tell it." "You'll have to walk home in the dark afterwards." "So we don't care," I said, already caring a lot. For 15 minutes, the man held us spellbound with a story of the bell ringing of its own accord in the small hours to alert the parish priest to a stranger who was lying seriously ill at the side door of the church. A man to whom the priest administered the last rites before sending for the doctor and then discovering on his return to the doorway that the man had disappeared. A week later, the parish priest saw the man's photograph in a national newspaper. He had been hanged in Mountjoy Prison on the night the bell had rung, on the night the priest had found him. "That's the very door where he was found, the side aisle door," the man said. And as he did, right on cue, the door opened and a stooped figure scurried from the church. We sat bolt upright, terrified, the woman in the confessional already gone from our minds. "Now," the man said, "I think the curate is free for the next confession. In with you, and make it a good one." Much later, back at home, my mother asked if I told the priest about the cigarettes. "I did." "And did he give you a penance?" "Three Hail Marys." "Three Hail Marys? Are you sure you told him everything? That you stole them and smoked them?" "I did, everything." "And that was all he said?" "He said one other thing." "And what was that?" "He said, worse things happen in people's lives."
Steamboat. The call rang out across the estuary, and fishermen in every small punt within earshot jerked their heads around. Our small open wooden punts were ranged across the river on an afternoon flood tide. Overhead, the sun beat down on a wonderful July afternoon ashore, but a southwesterly wind meant that a jumper and oilskins were essential kit on the water. Downriver, the estuary widened, creating the shorelines of Waterford and Wexford, which guided the three sister rivers of the Barrow Northern Shore to the sea. The sisters met at Cheek Point, and it was also the junction for the ports of Waterford and New Ross, a busy shipping area that presented additional challenges for fishermen. Now a huge ship was surging up the estuary, the bow opening up on Buttermilk Castle on the Wexford shore. The speed was apparent in the progress she made, and soon the entire length of the ship was obvious as the white superstructure astern appeared, where a pilot advised her captain on the channel. "Steamboat!" A more theatrical cry further up the estuary, and within moments, every punt from Moran's Poles, Mount Key, Cheek Point, and the Rookery were on alert. Some took little notice, secure in the knowledge that, because of where their nets were currently drifting, they were outside the ship's reach. Others were more problematic. These were just off the main channel and could, with some degree of certainty, leave the nets as they were. But perhaps they might lower the outboard engine and steam out to stand by the outer end, better to mark their position. Several, however, were like us, drifting across the channel and needing to haul the nets aboard. The drift was gone, and they were cursing their luck. Paul Duffin and myself were in our early 20s, but already seasoned salmon fishermen. Our tar-hulled punt with green topworks and a white painted band had caught its fair share of salmon that summer using the light green nylon drift nets that hung in a curtained line in the water, attempting to snare the king of all fish. Earlier, we had come across on the flood tide from the village, our punt jostling with the others on the Shelbourne banks on the Wexford shore. As the black suede of mud was covered by the incoming tide, it was followed by noisy seed birds who hungrily hunted across it on webbed feet for shellfish. Eventually, we got an opportunity to set our nets in towards the bank, and then with strokes on the oars, we drifted apace, constantly watching for signs of our prey. Later, we would haul the nets aboard, having drifted to Great Island Power Station, and then steam back down against the tide to try reset once more. With few options, we opted to set half and half. Half the nets in the tide, half on the shallow waters of the now covered mud. A good drift, but the risk was that as the nets drifted away into the tide, a ship would come. "Steamboat!" Paul took the cork rope, I took the lead rope, and tensing our muscles, we started to haul, hand over hand. It was an odd phrase when you thought about it in this age of oil-fueled vessels. The first regular coal-burning steamboat in these waters was in 1826, when the Nora Crenna spurned reliance on sail and wind, bringing a greater degree of regularity between Waterford and our ancient trading link of Bristol. Nearly 150 years later, in 1962, the last steamer coasting vessel crossed between Waterford and Liverpool, Clyde Shipping's Rockabille. Although in 1985 one steamer remained in the harbour, she was no danger to fishermen, for she was a slow-moving dredger called the Port Lauriga, which clung tenaciously to coal and steam. Her skipper was Michael Heffernan, originally from Cheek Point, and Michael and his crew would no more come near a drift net than we would go near a water bailiff. No, the shout that warned of ships was just a tradition, and the fishermen of Waterford Harbour were nothing if not soaked in traditions. Paul and I had most of the nets aboard when a shiny blue container ship owned by the Waterford-based Bell Lines Company passed us by. Many of the crew were men from around the harbour, and if they had their way, they would try and avoid us too. But the master was on a time schedule, and nothing could be allowed to slow his journey. Our drift was done, and still with empty nets aboard, we faced the decision. Fish don't ring bells, they say, and maybe the next drift might reward us. But closer to high tide meant more risk of ships. And we dreaded hearing that cry again that day. "Steamboat!"
I wrote this for the birth mother of one of my children. The day our daughter was delivered to us, I had this kind of premonition that one day in the future, her birth mother would find her and would surprise us. And I was right. Baby clothes. The first time I undressed the child, the stump of the cord withered and dropped into my hand. And the clothes she was delivered in, the tiny vest with cream satin ribbons, the pink baby grow with a rabbit motif. I swaddled them in the candlewick wrap, tucked them in a box to be stowed away, ready for the day you would come to claim her. So on that raw March night, when you hammered on our door as if your very life depended on it, I was not surprised that my daughter's eyes looked at me from your tear-swollen face. She heard the commotion and tore downstairs, my daughter, your baby. I watched as you faced each other before she took fright and fled. All I could do was offer you the bundle I had kept safe for 19 years. You pressed her baby clothes to your face, and I held you there on our hearth as torrents of grief raged around us.
The first time I failed my driving test was the first time I'd ever driven with the lights on. It was late on a dark November afternoon. School runs, the first rumblings of rush hour, fat drops of rain falling on the north of the city. It was the first time I'd driven with the wipers going. Turning right from minor road to major, I failed to notice the amber light until it was almost too late. I slammed the brakes in panic, and the curt, narrow man in the passenger's seat bounced forward theatrically, straining his seatbelt. I was unsurprised when, upon re-entering the cramped fluorescent office, he uttered the words, "I'm afraid that didn't go so well." Learning to drive is expensive, time-consuming, bureaucratic, frustrating, and in my case, interminable. Learning to drive as an adult, when you can't rely on a parent's car, when you have to pay for lessons just to get some practice, when, having left school behind some time ago, you've grown unaccustomed to being examined at all, is even more painful and even more expensive, too. The system is not designed for people like me, or so I tell myself. The test itself is a classic box-ticking exercise, riddled with arcane requirements and unspoken expectations. Any experienced driver would surely fail it. I've never been particularly comfortable in exam situations or any situation in which I must meet arbitrary preconditions. There is a part of me, an ill-tempered, impatient part that says, yes, okay, but why? What is the point of all this? Isn't it all a bit unnecessary? I mean, I've got the general gist of this. Shouldn't that be enough? Perhaps this is why I've never been able to hold down a proper job. The most disheartening part of learning to drive is having to watch other drivers, qualified drivers, allowed to roam the streets with impunity and without a qualified companion, doing dangerous, silly, incompetent things that I would never do. In the time since my first test, I have become a bitter, judgmental passenger. I watch out for sloppy gear changes, late indicators, imperfect roundabout maneuvers. When being driven on the motorway, I have learned to spot the drivers of other cars who are on their phone, texting or checking their email. There's a little wobble or a slow drift towards the white line. I become the prudish, exacting tester I most despise, marking some imaginary notepad with the details of this stranger's infractions. The second time I failed my driving test, I don't think it was entirely my fault. I decided to take the test in a small rural town near where I'd grown up. I'd heard it was easier there. It was. It was high summer, blue skies and a danger of sunburn. Early afternoon, Monday, few other cars on the road. I booked a lesson before the test and found myself with an instructor I'd never had before. She was distracted, playing with her phone, and the advice she did give me contradicted most of the advice I'd ever been given before. I'd been feeling good about the test, confident in my ability to pass it, but the lesson left me shaky and uncertain. Suddenly, I was second-guessing myself. I failed, not for any one error, but for an accumulation of small mistakes, most of which I'd never usually make. I was amazed that I'd failed. I'd been so sure I would pass. I'd felt, for the first time, that I actually knew how to drive. The day before I was due to take the test for the third time, I was on the train heading to my parents' house, looking over the literature, relearning my hand signals. I read through the official leaflets and, on their suggestion, checked my learner's permit. It had expired just 2 days before. I couldn't take the test. I couldn't even drive home from the train station with my dad. Firstly, because it would be illegal to drive with an expired permit, but more significantly, because I was boiling with rage. I could barely speak. It felt like the universe was trolling me, but I had no one to blame but myself. And that is always true in all of this. When it comes down to it, there is never anyone to blame but myself. It's all on me. Maybe it's because of this sense of personal responsibility that not driving has, for me, become an ever-present embarrassment. It feels now like being able to drive, being allowed to drive, will unlock something in my life. I'm convinced that I will never be able to really consider myself an adult until I can get in a car and drive away. None of the symbolic accoutrements of traditional adult life are available to me until this obstacle is overcome. No home in the country for me, no kids to drag around. I mean, I can't even do a big weekly shop. Honestly, what kind of man can't drive? My brothers, younger than me, both drive. Even though we live in the city, my friends all drive. I'm the passenger, the burden, the bus riding incompetent with a stack of train tickets and a bicycle pump. My bags are heavy. It's raining hard. I guess I'll walk.
Every night during the summer long ago, I'd walk with my sisters to the Cayleys in Ring. I was a reluctant attendee, as I was shy at the time and I didn't know many boys. But there was a sort of pressure to befriend them. My two aunts frequently pointed out to me that I'd never meet boys if I didn't go to the Cayley. So with the great sigh of all teenagers who come to expect a certain amount of ritual torture in their lives, I became part of that crocodile of young people from all over the parish, as well as students from the Irish College, who made our way to the Cayley each night. This was in the 70s in West County Waterford. The fashion at the time was to wear maxi skirts, platform shoes and tank tops, which were not ideal for dancing, but were exactly right for the Cayley. That was really a kind of fashion show for us girls. So while the sun was slipping slowly down behind the Knockmail Downs, we'd file into the little hall in clothes that reflected the sky outside, which was streaked in orange, red, yellow, purple and navy, all the colours of a summer sunset. I remember the knot of people at the doorway, where bold boys would try to slip in without being spotted by the suited ticket collector, Paddy Tobin. The rest of us paid our money and went in an orderly fashion, drawn by the pulsing strains of the music. Inside the door, the press of people would carry us along as we moved down the sides of the hall. I remember the three musicians seated on a raised dais, looking out over our heads, lost in the music, their faces blank, their eyes in a sort of trance. And reigning supreme, the master of ceremonies, Seamus O'Clerig, on Farrati. Cas ar yesh! Cas ar clay! Turn to the right, turn to the left, he'd cry. His instructions continued throughout the night, directing us, extolling us, inciting us. Slash came ar yesh! Slash came ar clay! Sidestep to the right, sidestep to the left. His voice was like the steady rush of waves against the quay wall. He'd call out the dances, Fali Limni, Unsi Nahinsha, Anstaki Norna, the walls of Limerick, the siege of Venice, the stack of barley. When it seemed like hundreds of us were moving as one and bellowing his instructions all the while, he'd sometimes, like a military strategist, make a sortie into a knot of boys if he suspected they were messing at the bottom of the hall, playing with matches, stink bombs or flick knives, or cradling a cigarette surreptitiously in their hand. At the start of a dance, I'd wait at the side of the hall, squirming with embarrassment, but hoping against hope that I'd be asked out to take part. If I was left standing while all those around me stepped out onto the floor, I'd shrink back, puce with self-consciousness, and try to make myself as small as possible. If I was invited out, I'd blush and follow him out to the centre of the floor. Side by side, we'd wait for the powerful beat to begin. At the last minute, we'd join hands. Then it was game on, and we'd march around the hall in time to the music. We all especially loved the 16-hand reel. This was a heart-stopping event from the very first bars of music. We'd stand in a circle waiting for the off. Then we'd all fly in one direction, a great wheel of eight couples, 16 feet going one way, and then suddenly we'd have to change and go the other way. It was a magnificently choreographed piece of dance. Stomping, standing, hopping, skipping, we'd lift our 16 hands linked like a chain and create a bridge for other couples to pass under. The high point happened when the music stopped and we had to pause breathless and stamp as one with our feet. It was then that every stomp, along with the smack of our hands on our thighs, seemed to echo down the boreen and reverberate out into the night. Each couple had a moment in the centre of this great wheel. Then the music would shift up a notch and the whole circle would take off again. There was always a concert at the end of the summer, and Seamus O'Clerig, the Fear an Tí, would stand at the top and recite the Croppy Boy, recalling the poor rebel who had been shot through the chest far from his wife and family, left to die alone on the wet grass. Shinter heve a tleve, honig mern croppy bocht, vi an drucht go traumer a eden, vi peleir trina ocht. Vi se a vad on a charde, e vad on a hachus a vunni, is ean a einar fache, an veer for fluch in a lee. And as the tolling voice of the Cayley master filled the hall, the boys would stop their messing, the girls would stop their whispering, and we would all listen. Not so long ago, I went to the Cayley and Ring College to revisit the scene of so many nights in my youth. I looked in and I saw young people all following the steps of the dance, going up the line, passing under each other's arms, swinging joyfully. But I was too big, too old to take part, too much part of the wide world. And I knew I had lost something. Still, it struck me that I'd been lucky. I'd been encouraged to attend night after night, even if I was often left standing like a stúchán at the sidelines.
That was a selection from Sunday Miscellany live at the Theatre Royal Waterford last year as part of Waterford Writers Weekend at Imagine Arts Festival. And this year's festival has just taken place online and all the events are still available to watch free at imagineartsfestival.com. The scripts this morning were An Afternoon in November by John McKenna, Steamboat by Andrew Doherty, Baby Clothes, a poem by A.M. Cousins, Learning to Drive by Ian Mullaney, and Those Summer Nights of Long Ago at the Cayley by Catherine Foley. The music we heard was In a Shear by Thomas Walsh, played on accordion, fiddle and guitar by Benny McCarthy, Brendan Clancy and Donal Clancy. The Steam Packet and Miss MacLeod's Reel played on Illan Pipes by David Power. A Stoirm an Chrí played on Tin Whistle, also by David Power. Living in Yesterday, composed and performed by the Kalimbas, Cathy Forrestal and Cliona Gahan on vocals and Damien Keogh on guitar and vocals. And the drops of Brandy, a slip jig played by David Power on Illan Pipes, with Benny McCarthy on button accordion, Brendan Clancy on fiddle, and Donal Clancy on guitar. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey. The producer is Sarah Binchy. And for more from this and other RTE Culture programmes, see rte.ie/culture.
RTE Radio 1.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.